At this time, we know that 12 U.S. service members have been killed in the attack, and 15 more service members have been injured. A number of Afghan civilians were also killed and injured in the attack.
A predicted terrorist attack has taken place. It's Friday, the 27th of August, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, Afghans living in India are demanding refugee status. Reports of violence by Taliban in Afghanistan. Japan finds 1.5 million doses of contaminated vaccine. Australia plans to launch its first commercial rocket. It is all on today's VOA Asia. Two suicide bombers and gunmen have targeted crowds of Afghans flocking to Kabul's airport in the waning days of a massive airlift that has drawn thousands of people seeking to flee the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan. An Afghan official says at least 60 Afghans were killed, 143 wounded. U.S. officials said 12 U.S. service members were killed, including 11 Marines and a Navy medic. A U.S. official said the complex attack was believed to have been carried out by the Islamic State group. The U.S. general overseeing the Afghanistan evacuation says the U.S. will go after the perpetrators of the Kabul airport attacks if they can be found. General Frank McKenzie said Thursday's attacks were believed to have been carried out by fighters associated with the Islamic State group's Afghanistan affiliate.
Two suicide bombers assessed to have been ISIS fighters detonated in the vicinity of the Abbey Gate at Hamad Karzai International Airport and in the vicinity of the Baron Hotel, which is immediately adjacent. The attack on the Abbey Gate was followed by a number of ISIS gunmen who opened fire on civilians and military forces.
McKenzie said the attacks would not stop the United States from continuing its evacuation of Americans and others. Joining us is VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, what else did General McKenzie address?
Well, General McKenzie said that the airport was continuing to evacuate. He said that ISIS, Islamic State, will not deter the United States from finishing its mission of getting U.S. and at-risk Afghans out of Afghanistan. He said, "I assure you of that." He was very defiant about the attack, saying clear-eyed that they are prepared for potentially more attacks. He discussed some of them with reporters. He said that they have heard reports of suicide vehicle-borne IED attacks. He said that Islamic State would like to launch a rocket into the airport, but the United States has a lot of defenses that are prepared and can deter any such attack like that. Should the Islamic State try to launch an attack at a U.S. or coalition or allied aircraft. But he was also very somber. He said, "It's a hard day today. You know, this is not something that you want to see happen clearly on the ground. It is something that they have expected for days. The intelligence has been coming in for days that there was a high threat of an Islamic State attack." So while they knew that this could potentially happen, McKenzie was trying to explain that it's really hard to stop an attack of this nature, because if you're screening people into an airport, you have to make sure that they do not have any sort of weapons or bombs before they get on a plane, because that's even more casualties. We're talking about hundreds of casualties at that point. So he says it's dangerous work that these Marines, that these troops are doing, but they have to get as close to every person that's going through the airport as possible. Look them in the eye, he said. Touch their clothes. Feel and make sure there's no weapons in order to make sure that the airport remains secure. And he said the airport is still secure.
VOA Pentagon correspondent is Carla Babb. Thanks, Carla.
Thank you.
This is VOA Asia. These are some of the stories you'll find at voanews.com. U.S. Vice President raises rights issues during visit to Vietnam. Possible Havana Syndrome incidents probed in VP Harris's delay from Singapore to Vietnam. The school year starts on September 1st in China. Most students face a new mandatory class. Xi Jinping's thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics for a new era. Afghan women's rights activists fear exclusion from public life. Afghan girls' boarding school temporarily relocated to Rwanda. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Hundreds of Afghans living in India are demanding refugee status from the United Nations Refugee Agency, saying that the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan has ended their chances of returning home. Anjana Pasricha visited an ongoing Afghan protest that began this week in the Indian capital.
These slogans by Afghans living in New Delhi have been ringing in the aftermath of the swift Taliban takeover outside the office of UNHCR, the United Nations Refugee Agency. India has traditionally given sanctuary to those escaping conflict-ridden Afghanistan. However, many have been living for years as asylum seekers because they have not been recognized as refugees. That denies them access to education or jobs.
UNHCR office do not do anything for our future.
Sahil Zahiri, a medical school graduate, fled to India in 2018 after suffering violence by the Taliban.
I came here because I was getting safety, but I cannot enroll in a postgraduate course or get a job. I've applied to 15 or 20 hospitals, but they have all rejected me, saying I do not have a bank account.
Many of the demonstrators are women, worried about the future of their children. They say they have no hopes of resettlement.
We are not able to go back to Afghanistan. We face many problems. My children can't study. We are not human. My children doesn't have any rights that they study. What should we do?
I don't get work. With the identity card I get as an asylum seeker, I cannot get a job or admission in a good school because I don't have a refugee card.
I have lost all my knowledge. All that I learned is gone.
Their demand for formal refugee status from the United Nations has intensified after the Taliban takeover, which Afghans living outside the country fear has shut out chances of returning home. India has no official refugee policy. These Afghans, though, say they cannot keep living in limbo.
If India does not accept them or let them settle here, then the UN should send them to some other country like Australia and Canada, which are welcoming Afghans.
After the Taliban takeover, India has offered emergency visas for those escaping Afghanistan. These demonstrators say the plight of those who came in the past should also be addressed. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
U.S. lawmakers urged President Joe Biden Wednesday to evacuate hundreds of people affiliated with the U.S. Agency for Global Media from Afghanistan as Washington rushes to meet a troop withdrawal deadline of August 31st. In a letter sent to Biden on Tuesday, Senator Ben Cardin and Representative William Keating said about 550 people, employees of USAGM and their families, are still trying to leave Afghanistan. USAGM is an independent federal agency that encompasses several news networks, including the Voice of America. Evacuation efforts for Afghan journalists have increased this week amid reports that Taliban fighters have been searching the homes of some media workers. The reports of harassment and searches come a week after the Taliban held its first news conference in Kabul. This is VOA Asia. Happening now in Asia, authorities have reported 68 new community infection cases of the coronavirus on Thursday in New Zealand, the largest daily increase since April of last year. New Zealand went into a strict lockdown last week as the government tries to stamp out the Delta variant outbreak. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. As the Taliban continue to move forward to create what they're calling an inclusive Islamic government, rights groups have recently reported acts of violence committed by the insurgents. In July, Amnesty International recounted eyewitness reports of Taliban fighters killing 9 ethnic Hazara men after taking control of Afghanistan's Ghazni province. The UN Human Rights Chief, Michelle Bachelet, warned Tuesday that she had received credible reports of severe abuses in areas under Taliban control in Afghanistan, including summary executions of civilians and security forces who had laid down their arms and restrictions on women. VOA's Steve Miller spoke with Amnesty International's Brian Kastner, senior crisis advisor with the group's crisis response program.
The concern is that we've spent so much time focusing on Kabul and the airport that we really don't know what's going on in the rest of the country. And partly that's because the Taliban have cut cell phone service in many of these areas. And so the only videos and photos that are coming out from large parts of the country are what Taliban-friendly media or social media accounts are putting out. So, you know, for our report, we managed to prove one massacre in one small town, in one district in Ghazni. And we just don't know what's happening in other places. But I have a hard time believing that we found the only massacre, right? So I think that there is, what's likely is that despite Taliban statements in the capital, that the actual Taliban fighters in large parts of the country are reverting to form and doing what they've always done, in which case it's targeting women, targeting ethnic minorities, targeting people that they think are with the government or journalists or human rights defenders.
So in your opinion, what needs to be done to get aid to those individuals who need it in Afghanistan, given what took place on Tuesday at the United Nations Human Rights Council?
Yeah, the Human Rights Council was extremely disappointing. The situation is changing by the hour and by the day, and they've called for a report to be released in March of next year. It's just absolutely inadequate in every way. So our concern is a few things. One is, as you say, everyone that needs to get out should be getting out. Secondarily, in addition, you know, we're setting the stage for a real humanitarian crisis because there were so many non-governmental organizations that provided the food, that provided the healthcare, that provided the services in a lot of rural Afghanistan. Those networks have completely fallen apart. And so aid is not coming to a lot of places. And then third, I mean, there are many credible reports of the Taliban keeping lists and going house to house and looking for individual journalists, interpreters, people that worked with Western forces, people that spoke to the media or with human rights groups. And those people absolutely need to be protected. And we need to monitor that, you know, if the Taliban say they are not going to be doing these killings and targetings, we need to be monitoring and making sure that's not happening. Last thing is that there's an absolutely heroic effort going on when it comes to the U.S. military and other NATO militaries moving people out by airlift, getting people on the plane, getting them to other places. But that effort is completely wasted if you cannot get everyone through the gate that needs to be gotten through, and if there's nowhere for these people to go once they get on the plane. And so there's a middle section of this puzzle that has been fixed, but at either end, especially when it comes to getting people inside the gate and getting processed, I don't think you can say enough how completely inadequate and unsatisfactory and just horrific it is that people are being turned away because of paperwork and because we can't figure out how to operate a gate and let people inside.
VOA Steve Miller spoke with Amnesty International's Brian Kastner, senior crisis advisor with the group's crisis response program.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. Nearly 400 evacuated Afghans arrived on Thursday in Seoul, where the government said it was amending the law to allow long-term stays for those who worked on South Korean projects in Afghanistan. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Japan is suspending the use of 1.63 million doses of Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine after several vials were found to be contaminated. The health ministry announced the suspension Thursday after Takeda Pharmaceutical, a domestic drug maker in charge of sales and distribution of the vaccine, received reports of contamination from several vaccination sites. The defense ministry said doses from one of the suspended batches had been administered at a mass vaccination site in the western prefecture of Osaka between August 6th and August 20th. But the health ministry said no reports of adverse effects have been reported from any inoculations from the affected batches. The contaminated vials were likely produced at a manufacturing plant in Spain contracted by Moderna to produce the vials. The Qantas Group posted a $2.35 billion Australian dollar pandemic-related annual loss Thursday and forecast Australia will reopen to international travel in December. Alan Joyce, Qantas's chief executive officer, says his company has been hit very hard by the pandemic.
I don't think there's another company in Australia that has been impacted by COVID as much as Qantas. These are big numbers. And they sum up what continues to be a very tough time for the industry, the company, and our people. Sadly, behind these numbers, there are thousands of job losses, thousands of people stood down, and millions of cancelled trips. International borders were essentially closed for the entire year.
The Sydney-based airline company said it expected flights to countries with high vaccination rates, including the U.S., Britain, Japan, and Singapore, would resume in mid-December. Flights to countries with lower vaccination rates, including Indonesia, the Philippines, and South Africa, would restart from April next year at the earliest, Qantas said in a statement to the Australian Securities Exchange. Australia has had some of the world's toughest pandemic border restrictions since March 2020. Most Australians must ask the government for an exemption from a travel ban to leave the country, and foreigners are in most circumstances refused permission to enter. Making headlines in Asia, reports say a powerful new Hong Kong committee tasked with vetting politicians and officials for their loyalty disqualified an opposition lawmaker for the first time as authorities purge its institutions of anyone deemed disloyal to Beijing. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a Taiwanese company, Taispace, plans to launch Australia's first commercial rocket later this year. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The rocket is called Hapith 1, which means flying squirrel in a Taiwanese indigenous language. So far, no specific date for the rocket's launch has been given. However, officials say an experimental flight is planned this year from a private facility on the Eyre Peninsula in South Australia. Official approval was granted by the Australian government this week. Developers hope the vehicle will reach outer space, at least 100 kilometres above sea level, before falling back to Earth over the sea. The rocket's data, navigation and propulsion systems will be scrutinised. James Brown, the chief executive of the Space Industry Association of Australia, says it will be a significant mission.
This is the first sort of major rocket launch in about 40 years for Australia. So this is a rocket that's about 10 metres high. It's got two stages. It'll be launched from South Australia out over the ocean and it'll get to about 100 kilometres high. It's basically testing this Taiwanese technology, which is a rocket built around a hybrid engine. And if that works well, if it's all safe, if it's all reliable, then the plan is for this company to come back and launch a bigger rocket that's about 20 metres high that can carry up to 400 kilograms worth of satellite payloads into space. So it's a really exciting development for the industry.
Taispace is Taiwan's first private space company, which reportedly chose a site in Australia because of regulatory problems back home. The Taipei Times reported concerns over the legality of proposed launch sites in Taiwan. Researchers have said the project is potentially significant for both Australia's and Taiwan's space industries, which have lagged behind other space programs. Australia only established a domestic space agency in 2018. Alice Gorman, an associate professor at Flinders University and space exploration expert, says Australia is well positioned to benefit from the global space sector.
At the top of the country in the north, we're relatively close to the equator, and that's a huge advantage for launching satellites into geostationary orbit because you get the assistance of the Earth's rotation. In the south, where Southern Launch is developing its launch sites, we're perfectly located to launch things into polar orbit. And this is where a lot of our Earth observation satellites are, a lot of scientific satellites. And we're not looking at, you know, monumentally massive big rockets here. We're looking at small rockets, small satellites, and with both ends of the country able to specialise in different kinds of launch, we really do have a geographic advantage.
Australia's rocket launching heritage goes back decades. For years, launches were taking place regularly at the Woomera Range in South Australia, including missile experiments for the military. The site remains a major Australian defence and research facility. TiSpace has said it plans further suborbital launches and several orbital launches after this year's test flight. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
We continue on VOA Asia. Government officials in Mexico are not saying whether they'll uphold the U.S. immigration policy that keeps asylum seekers waiting in Mexico. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
Now that the U.S. Supreme Court refused to block a lower court ruling that reinstates the Trump-era policy requiring people to wait in Mexico for asylum hearings, Mexico's director for North American Affairs says that ruling is not binding in his country. He says there are discussions underway about whether Mexico will agree to hold the migrants. But President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has cooperated with the U.S. government in the past, blocking migrant caravans and deporting those trying to reach the U.S. border. It's expected he would cooperate again. Legally, though, there is no reason why the Biden administration can't again try to end the program known as the Migrant Protection Protocols. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Turning collectibles into a museum is something few people get a chance to do. But for one Hot Wheels collector near Washington, D.C., he's turned a childhood passion into a grown-up hobby he can share with others. VOA's Ronan Zakaria has details.
Would you buy this little toy car for $1 million? That's the price this collector has set, if he's ever willing to part with it.
Well, the rarest Hot Wheel in the world is the pink rear-loading beach bomb. It was a beach bomb, looks like a Volkswagen bus, made in 1969. And about 50 of them are known in the world.
It's only 50.
Of these tall, skinny. There's only two known in pink, and only one known with an unusual base. It's like a one-of-one prototype. So it's the rarest Hot Wheel in the world. It's not for sale unless you give me $1 million. I won't sell it for a penny less. I've had it for almost 22 years.
This toy may end up costing you much more than an actual car, but these are not mere toys. According to Bruce Pascal, a Hot Wheels collector with his own private museum in Gettysburg, Maryland, a suburb near Washington, D.C.
Like, I call it the East Coast Hot Wheels Museum. It's a 4,000 square foot building with 20 foot ceilings, and it's filled with my Hot Wheel collection. But it's not just Hot Wheels, as you'll see as we walk around. It's everything associated with the history of the company.
Aside from limited edition Hot Wheels miniature cars, there are poster, bubblegum, hair gel, and an original blueprint to make Hot Wheels. Rear cars and motorcycle can also be found.
Seeing this museum is honestly unbelievable for me. The museum has filled with so many rare items. I really love seeing them with my own eyes. Bruce Pascal is probably the top collector in America or even the world, I think.
Hot Wheels miniature cars have been around since 1968 and are still popular today, both among children and adult collectors. Ronan Zakaria, VOA News, Gettysburg, Maryland.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. You can find us on Instagram and YouTube and at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, Amy Hybels, Chris Cascao, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman. Stay safe and enjoy the day ahead.